Good morning, everyone. Janice and I have this ongoing joke because my name is Jane with an E and she calls me Jan without an E. But that's okay, except there's a few other Jans in the room from time to time. And I never know if she's talking to me or not sometimes. So when she'll call me up to speak or do something, I'm not sure and I wait and I hesitate. But it's all in good fun. And again, my name is Jane, and I am a recovered alcoholic, and I am very happy to be here this morning in my right mind. And good morning to all of you on this side of the world, and good evening to all of you on the other side of the world. I had shared a while back, we had a meeting, I forget if it was a morning or an evening meeting, and there were three of us that shared. So I got, like Janice said, I got to tell a little bit of my story. But this morning I understand I'll have a little bit more time to share with you what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And that's where I have really been meditating on what to share with you folk. So sit back and learn a little bit more about my journey. It's been a very interesting one. And as the world might put it, a colorful one. I used to regret my past very much, but God has shown me how to not live in regret, but live looking forward to the future and how I can help other people from my experiences in this life. And that is my desire, my only desire for ever sharing my testimony, is that someone somewhere will realize that there's hope for them, that God is no respecter of persons, and that he will help anyone who will call out to him. So I started out as a child. I love that Bill Cosby joke. And I grew up in upper New Jersey, USA, in an upper middle class home with two alcoholic parents. My father of Italian descent, and my mother was a Southerner from Mississippi. She was Irish and Dutch. We had a lot of wine in my Italian family, town home. My grandparents were not alcoholics. My father did become one. My father was a musician, and from the time he was 12 years old, so he always played in club dates and bars and things. And my mom couldn't boil water when she got married. She was a real Southern belle, spoiled. And she met my dad when he was in the Air Force down in Texas. And so it began. And I can almost see the demise of my family from the get-go, of the alcohol being involved, and in that time in the 50s and early 60s, it was very popular to drink and party, and I have movies of my folks in our home having all the parties with their friends, and very innocent, looking very innocent, and fun, just having fun. And as their marriage began to deteriorate, my mother wanted to live in upper New Jersey, and the homes at that time were more expensive. And my father wanted better for us, and because he saw his family go through the Depression. So he started working two jobs to be able to support that. And, of course, as you know, never home. And my mom, as long as she wanted the home, she also wanted my dad home. So, you know, you can't have the best of everything. So I grew up in a home where I had the best dresses in town and no family, and people coming home drunk and beating each other. And one of my fondest memories, and I say that jokingly, is my mother running into my room, stark naked, bleeding from the head. And, of course, the police always coming and asking me what happened as a young girl, and very shocking things that no child should ever see. And I swore to myself as a child I can remember saying, I'll never do this to my children. I'll never drink. I'll never. And, of course, fast forward a little bit, when things started to really get bad in the home, I became pregnant at 16. I really believe I did that subconsciously to get out of that hell that I was living, because when things really started to fall apart, my parents used me more than my two brothers as a tool between them to get their aggravation out. Not necessarily physical. I've never really been beaten, but just mentally. Another one of my fondest memories was we used to go to my grandparents, and either on Saturday or Sunday, and of course my mother had stopped going because of the trouble in the home. And my father would say, get in the car, come on, we're going. My mother would be sitting at the end of the couch telling us to get back upstairs, and my father would be telling us to get in the car. And the mental abuse as a child was just devastating, trying to figure out who we're supposed to please. So at a very young age, I can look back, and I became a people pleaser, trying to find love, trying to find out what love was all about. And so I got pregnant at 16, and of course back then, in the early mid-60s, you didn't go like it is now, go back to school and finish your education, and grandma watched the baby or whatever. You were shamed. It was still a shame to be married or to be pregnant out of wedlock. Not married, pregnant out of wedlock. So I married my son Scott's father. And went on, had him at, I was barely 17 when I had him. But for the first time in my life, I loved that little boy. And we were married for about 18 months, and I had a very good man. He was a very good man, but I just didn't know what it was like to be treated good. And I'd started drinking at that point. We drank, again, just, you know, nominally, if you might say, and but I had never been out. I'd never been out. I can remember somebody saying this last night, waiting for my parents. I wasn't allowed to get out until my parents got home, and they never came home. So I was a captive in my house when I was a kid. So now I was out, and when I got out, I went nuts. I mean, literally, I was out, and so I hurt this man very, very much, to my regret. He was ready. He was a little bit older. I was 16, and he was 18, going on 19. And he was ready to be married in the white picket fence, and the little boy, beautiful little boy. But I wasn't. I wasn't prepared for life at all, in any way, shape, or form. So I just ran amok, and I hurt him desperately, took his son from him. Unfortunately, he became a heroin addict, and he's now recovered from that, but he is a bad alcoholic, and I pray for him now till this day. So we stayed friends, but I was out running. I was out running, still trying to find love. My Scott was my bond with love, because I finally had someone that I could care for and cared for me. At the age of 2 and a half, excuse me, he developed a brain tumor, and it about floored me. I was 18 years old, almost 19 years old, and the only thing that I loved in the world, they were telling me, because I looked at God, doctors as God at that time, that my son would not live to see school. He would be dead before he was 5. I should go home and just prepare for that. Back then, they didn't have the diagnostic equipment they have now. They didn't have even a CAT scan then, if you can imagine how far we've come in our technology in a very short time. So it was the first time in my whole entire life, outside of saying any kind of repetitious prayer, because I was raised as a Roman Catholic, not a nominal Catholic, My grandmother loved the Lord, my Italian grandma, and so we were raised in a faith, so to speak, in a religion. But it was the first time I'd ever talked to God. I mean, literally, as I'm talking to you now. And I can tell you, it wasn't pretty. I have since come to know that He has broad shoulders, and He can take anything that we say and realize what's coming from our heart. And so I put my fist in the air, and I said, you know, if you want to hurt somebody, hurt me, because I believed back then that it was God that was dishing all this out, and not my baby. If you let Him live, I'll live my life any way I want, any way you want. And I didn't realize at that moment that I was making a promise to God. It was an angry promise, but it was a promise nonetheless, and I didn't even realize how true it would come to pass. Life went on. I was now a single parent looking to make a living. I didn't want to stay on any kind of welfare or anything. I've always been kind of enterprising. I started as a waitress and got a job, got a car, got an apartment. And from waitressing, there was a bar next door that the owner owned also. And I was too young to tend bar, so I became a dancer. And back then, again, dancing, I'm not making excuses for, dancing now. It was a little less lewd, though. We had beautiful costumes made. And so I, figured in my mind this was a good thing. Could make a lot extra money. So I became a dancer. And I did that for a few years. And, of course, the drinking got worse. You're working in a bar situation, in a bar attitude. Not feeling really good about myself, but on the other hand, not feeling really bad, but getting involved more and more with alcohol. When my son had gotten diagnosed, he was in Columbia Presbyterian Hospital for, oh mercy, almost a month, if I can remember back that far. And I, as you can imagine, I wanted to be with him as much as I possibly could. So I would go there at 7 in the morning over to New York from New Jersey. And I would be with him all day and then go to my gig or my dancing, wherever I had to go, whether it be in New York City or in New Jersey, at 9 o'clock at night and work till 3 o'clock in the morning. And it became a vicious cycle. I was living on 3 hours of sleep, approximately, sometimes none. And one night, one of the band members said to me, "You look terrible." And I did. I was a wreck. And I'll never forget, he gave me this little magic pill. And I took that pill, with the alcohol, of course, and I never danced so well in my life. And I was now finding the answer to all life's problems. If I took pills to stay up and took alcohol to go to sleep, I could beat this thing. I could do this with my son in the situation he was in. So everyone starts at a different point and the reasons that they start. But then when the noose gets tighter and tighter around your neck, you start to get dragged down that tunnel, the Alice in Wonderland tunnel, I call it. And so I went on with that scenario for quite a few years. Until I couldn't get these magical pills as readily as I did before. And I did get off of them, but continued now to drink even more and experiment with harder alcohols and shots and doing all sorts of things that just started spiraling everything else out of control. So fast forward a little bit again. Scott did not die at 5. He has since passed away in 2001. He was 34, not 5. So he didn't pass away at 5 like they thought. And I was in and out of doctor's offices, of course, forever. He had a very bad seizure disorder that they never could get straightened around. So we went on, and I became a bartender as I got older and got of age, I should say. So my life just went on. it went on that way. In the meantime, I'd had another child when my son, when they told me my son was going to die before he was 5, I again thought, no, God, you're not going to do this to me. You're not going to take the only thing out from under me that I love. So I purposely set out to get pregnant again. I was seeing a married man at the time, and who was telling me always that he was going to leave his wife. I believe if he's still alive, he's still with her. But I made up my mind and told him I was going to have another child. And I did. My daughter, that's now 35, I tell her all the time that she was the only planned child that I had. Because I did. I deliberately had her for fear that if Scott was taken from my life, I would totally collapse. And she's a lovely woman, and I love her dearly. But again, making wrong choices for what I thought were the right reasons. And it's amazing the hurt that we place down in people because of our choices, ungodly. I call them ungodly choices because out of ignorance, out of not knowing the right way, the right road. And so now I had 2 children and no husband, and a man that was promising me for years he was going to be my husband one day, and I believed that, and became quite a people pleaser. So not too many years from that point, I believe, if I'm recalling correctly, I'm trying to think, well, I guess it was a lot of years, I was introduced to God, not to AA, but to God, and I did sort of calm down my drinking. I became more of a controlled drinker, because again, I said, I've always been enterprising, I've always tried to take care of my family, so I had to work. So I really had to balance this drinking thing, and I think I managed it pretty well for quite a while. I rode along, you know, getting a little bit more sleep, of course, because my son wasn't in the hospital. But it still was not good. I was still empty inside, and I couldn't figure out why. I had my daughter now, and my son was still here, but this that emptiness lurked, and it lurked. And I had been raised in a neighborhood that there was a pastor, evangelist, actually, at the other end of the street, who I became very friendly with his daughter when we were young. And I was allowed to go with them when, you know, my parents were home, when they finally did show up. If I could go to youth group, I was allowed to go. So I, you know, when I was a kid, I was introduced to God in a manner of speaking. Didn't understand anything, you know, but was happy to be there. It was like a haven to me. I was a haven in their home. They had a home that ran like a home, and I would go down there as a soulless to get away from the hell that I was living. So in 1978, on February 5th, I was in a bar, of course. I had gone down, I had finished up my work in New Jersey, and it was a Saturday night, and I would often go over to New York City after hours and drink until the wee hours of the morning. And this particular night, I went to this after-hours club, and I saw this man standing at the dance floor. And I went up, you know, and he was kind of good-looking, kind of cute. And he had a real long face on, though. And I looked at him, and I said, cheer up, things are going to get worse. And he just laughed. And I didn't know that he'd had his spiritual awakening, but he had been praying for a wife, and God hadn't answered his prayer as quick as he'd like to. So he thought he might come back to the bar and just look around. Well, we sat in my car that morning and talked about God as I understand him. And like I said, as Janice said, this is not a religious meeting. This is an AA meeting. But this is my story, and this is what happened. And I gave my life to God on that night, and not knowing where this journey was going to take me. So I came home that morning and went looking, and realized 15 years had passed. I went looking for this family that had once made some sense to me. And I called up the church that we used to attend, and I asked this lady that answered the phone, and she said, well, that my friend was not her maiden name anymore, that she had gotten married. And I had a sinking feeling in my stomach as I thought maybe she'd moved away and I'd never be able to reach her. And but she was there. She was inside teaching Sunday school, and she called me back, and we began our friendship over again. And one of the things that I learned through all that is that no one can go back and make a brand new start, but anyone can start from now and make a brand new ending. And from that day on February 5th, 1978, that's what I realized happened to me. I didn't go back and make a brand new start, but I did start to make a brand new ending. And of course, that was quite a few years ago. So now I was on this journey, and with God, and it was the first time in my whole entire life that I was truly happy. My son, of course, brought happiness to my life, and my children bring happiness to my life. But I found joy, and I found true inner happiness in meeting this God that I had never understood as a child. And I'm still to this day growing to understand and love and have fellowship with and relationship with ever since and ever will. So I asked my friend, I said, you know, what should I do? Should I, you know, stop drinking? Should I quit my, I was working at the time in a very, very plush, beautiful restaurant in Paterson, New Jersey. And actually the two owners, two Greek ladies, when they saw this, revelation happened in my life, they wanted to know what it was all about. So they came into a Bible study with us, my friend and I. So they were kind of understanding a little bit what kind of journey I was on. But I didn't know what to do. I mean, I'm working in a nice restaurant, serving alcohol. At this point, I'm not drinking. I might have slipped one in here and there, but I wasn't drinking. And I was learning that, you know, God probably didn't want me doing that. So I asked my friend, you know, I said, Lenny, what should I do? Should I quit drinking? Should I quit smoking? Should I quit my bartending job? And she gave me the best advice that I give most women. I work in a jail ministry right now. And most women, God will show you what he wants you to do. And I try to give that advice to everyone. If they need help in sorting things out, sometimes I can help that. But our journey is our journey, and God is a very personal leader, and it's a one-on-one kind of deal. We can learn from each other, and we can certainly mentor each other, but when it comes right down to it, he has a purpose and a plan for each individual person, and he will lead you on that journey. So she gave me very good advice, and immediately when I took that advice, things began to happen, and there was a priest, actually, in the restaurant that every time I turned around, he had his glass out wanting another Doers on the Rocks. I'll never forget it as long as I live. And I just tried to stay away. I tried to stay in the corner. I tried to wash glasses. I tried to do anything not to give him any more alcohol, because there were these ladies there that were looking up to him and asking him questions. And at that point, you know, I was reading the other good book. The big book is very important in my life, but the other good book is where most of the principles came from. And so I was just like, I can't do this anymore. I just can't do this anymore. So I went up to my bosses and I told them I had to give my notice. And they were like, oh, we understand. So I went back to working in a diner overnight. Making $125 instead of perhaps $600 or so. And in 1978, that was quite a bit of money. And my mother lives in Florida, and I call her freaking out in Florida because she's still looking for the verse that says, God helps those who help themselves. And that's not what it says. It says, trust him, and he'll make your path straight. So she's like, what are you, crazy? You worked in a nice place. Why, you're gone nuts. You're out off the wall. You're holy roller. What's the matter with you? Now you have to understand, she lost her drinking buddy. So it was quite interesting where our paths took us. But that's a story for another time. But I met a man that was coming into the diner wanting to know why I was so happy all the time. And I told him I'd had this spiritual awakening and I'd met the God of my understanding, who is Jesus. And I was on this new path in my life. Well, he said he wanted that. Excuse me. So we began to study the word together, and we were married, and I was pregnant. I had my next daughter, who is now just turned 30, and I think I was pregnant with my son. They're 15 months apart, and my husband said to me that he didn't want to do this anymore. Like, the spiritual walk was just probably not for him. And now, he had stopped drinking also by then, of course, or we wouldn't have been married. And I realize now that, looking back, I didn't leave it in God's hands. I forced the issue. And you can't force anybody to do anything, folks. It just doesn't work. You can't twist anybody's arm to have them do anything. It's got to be a wanna. Many people have heard me say in these rooms, you got to get your wanna going. So, again, long story short, when he said that, I realized now that a rug started to pull out from under me. And I never knew up until very, very recently what the term dry drunk meant. And I had stopped drinking, and I believe very, very strongly, not because I wanted to, it was because I thought that's what I should do. And that led me down a very long path, or a few years anyway, seemed like forever, of struggling not to drink and trying to get my husband back on track with God so that we could begin this wonderful journey that had just taken place in my life. But it didn't work. It didn't work. He harassed me. He began harassing me because he had never known me before when I was drinking. I was not a nasty drunk. I was pretty happy drunk. But I was a big joke teller and loved it, loved entertaining people, loved making people laugh and have a good time, just searching for love. And in all the wrong places, of course. So now I was this dry drunk, if I can use that term, because I now realize that's what I was, and fighting to pick up a drink, but becoming very, very angry and resentful. And I had people in my church handing me books on how to be the wife of a happy husband. I didn't want him happy. I wanted him dead. I wanted him out of my life. He was the sole contender of everything that was wrong now happening again. Here we go again down this this tunnel, or this train track, with this tunnel with the light at the end, and it's another train every time. Every time I looked, there was another train. So we moved up here in 1985 to upstate New York. We bought a restaurant, a small restaurant in a little town. It was my mother-in-law and my husband and my sister-in-law, our four children, and our dog. And I prayed before I left a very strong church I was in down in New Jersey. Oh, God, if it's not your will, please close the doors. Oh, God, if it's not your will, please close the doors. Well, every door ran, you know, just flung open, and we were up here in no time. The deals went through. We found ourselves up here. So now I was away from any spiritual influence in my life, in a new state, in a new town, without anyone except God, who I was kind of becoming angry with now again, because my relationship was not on a true basis. It was a basis of works and trying to do the right thing, trying not to drink, trying not to smoke, trying to do all those things again, taking a spiral downhill. And my husband asked our friends from New Jersey to come up for our anniversary. And this was in 1986, just a year after we got up here. And I was telling him that we didn't need that. We had enough problems in our marriage. We didn't need anybody coming up here. But he insisted. And we went to this little restaurant that's not too far from where I am right now. And they started in again. How come you don't drink anymore? How come you don't? What's the matter with you? Why don't you get, you know? And I'll never forget it again. these pillars in our lives, these stones that we can go back and pinpoint just where we were in our journey are very meaningful. in our testimonies. I went up to the bar. I don't remember what I ordered. I have no idea, but I ordered. And it's almost like I could have turned around and seeing everybody in the room applaud. Yay, she's come to her senses. And they were. There was, everybody was happy. I wasn't this holy roller, crazed person, Jesus freak anymore. I was normal, so to speak. So I was just disgusted with myself. And now, of course, my husband was like, well, she is in it. I told him that he didn't know me before. He never met me when I was in my downward spiral with alcohol. So not too very long after, when I was drinking a gallon of wine every day, and he was like, whoa, put the brakes on. And I'll never forget telling him, in not a very nice language, don't ever blankety-blank tell me how much to drink, ever. And that started my journey really spiraling downhill again. And I wound up, for a fast forward a little bit, not very much, because it only took a very short time to get to the place I was before. And but the thing that got me before I went to rehab was my beautiful daughter that's now 35, my second baby that I told you about. She's very brilliant, and she was a straight-A student. She was starting to fail every subject. And I thank God that he used that to soften my heart, because I recognized I had started doing cocaine at that point. I was on a crash course to kill myself, and I realized it now. Back then, I really didn't, I don't think, consciously realize it. But the enemy had whispered in my ear that that I was the problem, and if I was out of here, everybody's life would go on. I could never make anyone happy. I was a mess. So, but my daughter, when I saw her life starting to deteriorate at 12 years old, I believe it was, it just got to my heart. I realize now, again, so many of these things are not conscious things, and I think everyone or a lot of people in here can relate that. We don't wake up in the morning and say, oh, nice day, I think I'll become an alcoholic. Sounds like a good day to maybe get a divorce. No, these things chip away at us until, you know, we just get dragged down to the bottom. But I did realize I was in trouble, and especially with the cocaine now added to the alcohol. And I don't know how many people in here have ever gone down that road, but it definitely is the big lie. You can still work, you can still function, but you're little by little killing yourself and needing more and more both alcohol and cocaine to make it through the day. So I called my friend again 15 years later and told her, I need help. I need a place. And I know now that God had me call her, because she wouldn't just pick a place. She would pray and investigate and find just the right place for her dear friend who was struggling. She had, of course, popped out of my life because she stayed on the straight and narrow. And that was a very good thing for her to do. It's not a bad thing. So I went to rehab. I went to a Christian rehab over by West Point. It's affiliated with Teen Challenge, called Walter Hoving Home. It's for women, and there were 60 women there, and I was there for a year. They ask you to submit. Now it's a 6-month or a year program. You have a choice, but back then it was a year program. And I decided that I wanted to complete this program. I had never in my life completed anything besides childbirth, and I had no control over that. So I've always been a good starter and never a good finisher. I'm still working on that. It's a day-to-day thing. But I went and I completed the year there. And on coming out of there, I had, of course, not had a drink or a drug in a year. I gave up the cocaine. The cocaine was out of my life. But, you know, drinking is legal. Cocaine, marijuana use, all those other things are not legalized by our great country over here. But alcohol is legal when you're over 21. So I did begin to drink again. I became a controlled drunk up until the day I stopped, actually. I would work again. In fact, in my last testimony, I think I shared with you folks that there was a lady in our town who was the mother of my son's best friend. I never really got to know her. She was the town drunk. She drank from 7 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon and went to bed. I started at 4 in the afternoon and drank till midnight. And that was acceptable, and it still is to this day. You're not considered a drunk, a town drunk, if you go to work and you maintain your family to a certain degree. You're okay. I wasn't okay. I was a wreck. And I had a chance to apologize to that dear woman before she died. I went to visit her on her deathbed in the hospital from cirrhosis and lung cancer. She was 48 years old, and apologized to her for having 15 years to be her friend and not doing that. So I made amends with her. They had told us when we left rehab that we should get involved in an AA program. I went, or an NA program. I went to one NA meeting, and I'll never forget that. There was a man that stood up and said that, oh, we're all a bunch of druggies. That's all we'll ever be, is a bunch of druggies. And he just continued on that realm. I guess you'd call him a dry, recovering drug addict. I don't know. There's got to be a term somewhere. There's a term for everything. And I walked out of that meeting and swore I'd never go back to another one. And I went to one other AA meeting with a dear friend of mine. She's very involved with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I worked with her up here in a diner. I worked in a diner up here for 15 years in Oneonta, New York. And I met my friend, and she took me to a meeting. And I enjoyed that meeting, but again, I never got involved in really in Alcoholics Anonymous until just a few years ago, when I got involved with a ministry, in a jail ministry, that they didn't need help with the Bible study at that point, but they needed help in leading an AA program. And from being an alcoholic, now at this point, I had stopped drinking. I had really been on my way now to regaining my trust in God and understanding who He is and His great love for me. And now that love was really sinking in, that He wasn't the bad guy up there with getting ready to drop the other shoe. He was a loving Heavenly Father, a loving God that really wanted to make sense out of my life. And if I would let Him, He would do that. So I did start leading with the help of about 4 other people, volunteers, this AA group of women. And I've met some very lovely people that I love very much in the sound of my voice that I got to know and really started to understand what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about. And I'm not involved with that particular ministry right now because I've moved. I've taken a job as a foster parent in a group home. I have teenagers. I'm 59 years old, and I adopted a little boy last year, who just turned 12. And I am very thankful to have another chance in life. And I'm still making amends. I think we always will be making amends, not trying to fix things, because I understand the meaning of forgiveness. You ask forgiveness from someone, and if they receive that, they get the basketball, so to speak, and then they have to deal with that what they need to do with that. But you're sort of free from the fact that you've done your best. I have an old saying that I say quite a bit, and you're probably tired of hearing it, but you can't unscramble eggs. You can't go back and get the yolks and the whites separated. But I have found that if you give God good ingredients, He makes great omelets. And that's where I'm at in this stage of my life. I think my children are a little bit envious of the fact that Russell now, who's 12, is being raised the way a child should be raised, with a sober mother, one in her right mind. And I tell them, you know, I can't go back and do it over. If I could, I would. I'd give my right arm. But I used to beat myself up for quite a while. I did. And I remember crying my kitchen door and my home that I was in. I'm in a state-run home right now. I work 24/7, but in my home in Wellsbridge, I remember my kitchen door being my little sanctuary. I would go there and talk to God and cry, and I remember telling him, "Oh, those wasted years," and I would sob and cry. And I remember one morning him saying to me, "Would you stop that? I don't waste anything. If you'll let me use what you went through to help others, we can really go places." And I remember that day, things changing drastically. And I said, okay. And we've been on that journey ever since. I'm looking forward right now to starting a Bible study over here in this county jail. It's a different county. And I believe that God is going to open that door, and I'm going to be able to go in and hopefully lead another AA meeting in there. Most of the women in the jail system suffer from some type of substance abuse. And when they get out and they don't get into a meeting or get someplace where they can really get on their feet, they wind up in that vicious cycle again and wind up back in incarcerated. And that's my passion. I found out through this journey that what you hate the most is what becomes your passion. And I hate alcohol. I hate families being torn apart by alcohol or other things. I love seeing restoration. I know that my God, my higher power, is a God of restoration, and there's nothing too difficult for him if you'll believe for it. And that's the journey that I'm on now. And I'm looking forward in the near future to opening a home for women coming out of jail. I thought it was prison, but I'm thinking that Papa wants me to start on the county level, and that's fine with me. He knows best. He sees the end from the beginning. So that's where I'm at. I'm looking at a home down in a town not too far from where I am right now. I've been asking why I've been working with these teenagers at my age, because it's a challenge. And but you know what? It's been a learning process to be able to prepare me for these women that are coming out of prison. Some of them have been in prison 4 years, 5 years, where their kids were little when they went in, and now they're teenagers, and to be able to help them and mentor them and teach them how to pick their battles, and because that's what I've been learning while I'm here. So there's a purpose and a plan for every step of our lives, and if we'll let God use those things to help other people, we can really make great omelets, folks. And I haven't been watching the clock, really. I've been really thankful for being able to share this little chapter in the book of Jane. I am writing a book right now, and it's interesting. I have about three titles for three books that I know God wants me to write, but I have to get one done at a time. That's what I talked about before, learning to finish what I start. And I now have three grandchildren. Anthony is 3, and Rocky is 2, and David is 6 months. And another story, another book that I'll have to write was my little daughter, my youngest daughter, who became a heroin addict. And she is now home. She was in prison, had my grandson in prison. And the miracles after miracles after miracles that God has done in that girl's life are incredible. But that's book number 2. So I will say goodbye for now. I hope that my story has helped someone to realize that if we never give up and always keep searching for that relationship with our higher power, I call him Papa because he is my heavenly father. He's the father that I never had. I never once remember my father telling me he loved me. He wrote it down in a couple of letters, but I never remember him putting his arms around me and telling me, "I love you, baby." But I hear it every day now from my Heavenly Father, and that sustains me. My father has since passed in 1995, and I'll see him again one day. I believe that with all my heart. I have forgiven him and released him, as I have all my parents and people that hurt me in my past. I have released them, and I am free. And I love being free. So I thank you very much for allowing me to share what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I pray that you all have a good God day, today's meeting day in our wonderful church that I go to. We hoot and holler. We make a lot of noise. We sing and shout and dance. We hear a good message, and it prepares me to go back out into the world again for a week and share what this wonderful God has done in my life, and especially with people that struggle with abuse, substance abuse, alcohol being the mainstay, and people that take other things to help ease the pain, and that's all it does for a little bit, and it makes it worse. So I hope I've helped, especially any newcomers here, to stay on with this program, stay on with the people here that are trying to help you or in your face-to-face meetings. Find a good mentor, find a good sponsor, someone that will love you and wrap their arms around you, not baby you or enable you, try to do it for you, but to come alongside and be a support. And there's one proverb that I love in the Word, and that is the kisses of a friend. The wounds of a friend are better than the kisses of an enemy. And sometimes you might get your feelings hurt by what someone might say or do, but they're really there to help, not to hurt you. So stick with it. You can do it. If I could do it, anybody can do it. And I tell women that all the time. If I could do it, anyone can do it. So I'll turn this back over to you, Janice, and I thank you again. My name is Jane, and I'm a very, very, very hopeful and thankful recovered alcoholic.